This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
Good morning. It's Monday, July the 26th, 2021. Welcome to Now with Dave Brown, coming to you on AMI Audio and AMI TV. I'm Dave Brown. Let's hit the horns and go! Coming up on the show today, Michelle McQuigg of the Canadian Press will share a weekend news recap with a discussion on what's happening at the Olympics. Digital accessibility specialist Didier Boudreau describes the accessibility shortcomings in the ESPN Fantasy Sports app. Film reviewer Amy Amanti will chat about the Netflix docuseries Penguin Town. Mark Aflalo of Double Tap Canada will tell you about Too Good To Go, an anti-waste food app that recently launched in Toronto. And Jim Crisco gives you the Western Regional Report and describes Saskatchewan's commitment to a new skills training program. Busy show coming your way over the course of the next couple of hours. We'll also have a sports chat with Jeff Ryman, Mike's big business story of the day, a regional news update, and of course, we'll also get the accessibility story roundup. But let's begin the show with our top story of the day. A BC Wildfire Service information officer says the province has so far seen 4,090 square kilometers scorched so far, which is about four times the 5 and 10 year averages. Carly DeRosier says the increase is caused by drought conditions, heat and dryness of vegetation in forests.
To date, we have had 409,000 hectares burned. And we compare that to the five-year average, which is 107,000 hectares. The 10-year average, 104,000.
The BC Wildfire Service says there are currently 258 blazes currently burning in the province. And then we look south of the border, where California's largest wildfire merged with a smaller blaze and destroyed homes in remote areas with limited access to firefighters. Numerous other fires are gaining strength and threatening property across the American West. ABC reporter Zareen Shah has more.
Evacuation orders for the almost 200,000-acre Dixie Fire, sending residents fleeing from their homes. Near Lake Tahoe, firefighters urgently trying to save any structures they can. Jumbo jets dropping retardant on the Tamarack Fire. That fire still just 27% contained. A new satellite image now showing thick smoke encasing much of the West from the dozens of large wildfires.
Air quality alerts are in effect from Washington State to Colorado. Of course, we're also seeing wildfires across Canada beyond the BC wildfires in Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and Northern Ontario. And the impact of those fires in Northern Ontario having an air quality impact even here in Southern Ontario. Which leads into our next story. An emergency room doctor says as wildfires become more frequent, smoke-related illnesses have the potential to be deadly. And it's time for communities in fire-prone areas started to plan for the fallout. Beth Layton has more.
Dr. Courtney Howard is an emergency room physician in Yellowknife. She agrees there's little data on links between health and wildfire smoke, but she was working in 2014 when massive fires charred the Northwest Territories and says it was challenging to treat the resulting asthma cases. Air pollution is known to increase deaths from cancer, stroke, heart, and lung disease, and Howard says the young, elderly, or ill should have more options than simply to shelter at home from wildfire smoke. She says it's time communities plan clean air shelters or other ventilated infrastructure to adequately protect the most vulnerable. Beth Layton, The Canadian Press.
Now let's pivot over to COVID-19. Looking into the Canadian context at the active caseload, there are 4,628 active cases of the virus in Canada. 26,547 people have died since the beginning of the pandemic. As we look at the vaccination side of the story, the provinces and territories are reporting the administration of over 125,000 doses of vaccine yesterday. That number sounds a bit low. It is worth noting that some jurisdictions do not report their Sunday numbers, so we'll see a slightly higher number tomorrow. Looking at the number of Canadians who have been vaccinated, 79.92% of eligible Canadians have received at least one shot. 61.77% of eligible Canadians are fully vaccinated. But the big story when it comes to COVID is currently coming from south of the border. Health officials in the U.S. are sounding the alarm over surging COVID cases. Reporter Elwin Lopez has more.
At Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles, nearly all the COVID patients are unvaccinated, many of them telling doctors they wish they had gotten the shot. Dr. Oren Friedman sharing what he saw firsthand with one patient.
I could see, unbelievable regrets. He was nervous. He's anxious. I can tell you he's not expected to survive. And I think all I can say to the public is you don't want to be in this situation. Trust us. Trust us. You don't want to be in the hospital saying, I regret not getting a vaccine. Just do it.
America's top infectious disease expert and White House chief medical advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, is warning the U.S. is going in the wrong direction and that he's very frustrated. And then as you look over the Atlantic, France's parliament approved a law early Monday morning requiring special virus passes for all restaurants and domestic travel and mandating vaccines for all healthcare workers. Both measures have prompted protests and political tensions. President Emmanuel Macron and his government say they are needed to protect vulnerable populations and hospitals as infections rebound and to avoid new lockdowns. The law requires all workers in the healthcare sector to start getting vaccinated by September the 15th or risk suspension. It also requires a health pass to enter all restaurants, trains, planes, and some other public venues. It initially applies to all adults, but will apply to everyone 12 and older starting September the 30th. To get the pass, people must have proof they are fully vaccinated, recently tested negative, or recently recovered from the virus. Paper or digital documents will be accepted. The law says a government decree will outline how to handle vaccination documents from other countries. And one more COVID-related story to share with you this morning. A survey from Angus Reid Institute suggests the pandemic has changed the way most Canadians think about their future with long-term care. Jerry Smith takes a closer look.
The poll says the views of more than 80% of respondents have changed since COVID-19. About half say they now dread the thought of themselves or their loved ones being in long-term care. Long-term care residents have accounted for the majority of virus deaths. Three-quarters say significant changes, if not a complete overhaul, should happen in long-term care, though responses were divided on just how to do that. Three-quarters of respondents also say they support making long-term care a fully integrated part of the public health system. Jerry Smith, The Canadian Press.
Let's get to our daily polls. At AMI Audio is where you find us on Twitter. Accessible Media Inc. is where you find us on Facebook. Friday's question was about the Olympics, and today's question will be about the Olympics too. On Friday, we asked you, how much attention will you pay to the Tokyo Olympics and Paralympics? Watch as much as I can. That was 33% of you. 17% of you said check daily results. 33% of you said watch once in a while. And 17% of you said I am not interested. Today's daily poll at AMI Audio on Twitter, Accessible Media Inc. on Facebook, also about the Olympics. If you could compete in any Summer Olympic or Paralympic sport, what would it be? And we do want you to write in with your specific sports, but I've got some general categories here for you. Track and field, water sports, cycling, or gymnastics. Those are a couple of the biggies, but of course there are things like judo and boxing, some of the fun combat sports, games like volleyball, a handball are in the mix, basketball. There's all kinds of good stuff. Let's bring in Sam Robinson first. Sam, you're filling in for Daniel Panamondo for the next couple of weeks. Now, I know there's no such thing as competitive yoga just yet at the Olympics, but I'm curious, what might you want to partake in?
I've seen this, and what I really want to do, surfing.
Oh, yeah.
People forget surfing and also now skateboarding.
Mm-hmm.
But surfing, if you're talking about like competitions that will potentially be good for the kind of lifestyle that you want to lead, surfing. I'm going to surfing.
I like that one.
Live in Hawaii.
Little time by the ocean. That's some hardcore training right there. Just watch out for the sharks along the way. Nazreen Abdelmajid, what about you? If you could take part in any summer Olympic activity, which one would it be?
Dave, I have to ask, is this based on my quote-unquote skills or delusional question?
This is based purely on delusion, although hopefully you would do the training, you know, to get yourself into top Olympic form.
Okay, fine. Then if that is so, I'll do gymnastics. Gymnastics is something that I've always wanted to do, and I even actually mentioned to my parents, I wish you got me into gymnastics when I was younger. Dream of mine.
Flip-flopping and flying with Nazreen all over that gymnastic studio. Thank you for that one, Nazreen. Let's bring in Mike Ross. Mike, what about you? What Olympic sport would draw your attention if you were to compete?
Well, since we're dealing in delusions.
Yes, we're in the world of delusion here.
I have suddenly, like the lion in Wizard of Oz, I've gained courage, and I'm going to do the high platform diving.
Oh, yeah.
I'm amazed at their ability. How they crash through that water and do it like straight, no belly flops. Well, sometimes you see a belly flop or two, but for the most part, it's super impressive. They come so close to that cement platform with their heads. Mm-hmm. I don't know how they do it, and it just takes a tremendous amount of skill and courage as far as I'm concerned. So I would be able to do that in the delusional Olympics.
I'm going to save my answer from when we talked to Michelle. Mike, I remember when I was a young lad, maybe 7 or 8, 9 years old, I got up to the 3-meter diving board at the Montreal West swimming pool, and I could not take the jump. I had to retract myself, take the embarrassing crawl of shame back down the ladder because I could not bring myself to jump off that diving board. So the 10-meter platform, too much for me. Mike, thank you for this.
Okay, Dave.
That's Mike Ross. At AMI Audio is where you find us on Twitter. Accessible Media Inc. is where you find us on Facebook. What Olympic sport, Summer Olympic or Paralympic sport, would you take part in if you had the opportunity? Hey, maybe social media is not your game. Feel free to send us an email, feedback@AMI.ca, feedback@AMI.ca, or give us a call, 1-866-509-4545, 1-866-509-4545. Hey, it's possible that you were an Olympic athlete or a Paralympic athlete and want to share a story about your experience. Feel free to reach out to the show and talk about that as well. We'd love to hear from you. Before we get to Michelle McQuigg in a couple of minutes, let's get to Nazreen Abdel-Majid at the AMI Weather Desk.
Here is your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada. In St. John's, cloudy, 60% chance of showers becoming a mix of sun and clouds with a high of 17. Halifax, mainly cloudy, periods of drizzle, then a chance of showers. There's a risk of a thunder shower, high of 26, except a high of 20 along parts of the coast and a humidex of 34. In Montreal, mix of sun and clouds, 60% chance of showers with a risk of thunderstorm. We're expecting local smoke and a high of 27 with a humidex of 33. In Ottawa, mix of sun and clouds, chance of showers with a risk of a thunderstorm, high of 27 and a humidex of 32. In Toronto, sunny, then a mix of sun and clouds with a chance of showers, local smoke, high of 31 and a humidex of 34. Thunder Bay, sunny, then a mix of sun and clouds with a chance of showers. There's a risk of a thunderstorm with local smoke and a high of 30 and a humidex of 33. In Winnipeg, mix of sun and clouds, chance of showers with a risk of a thunderstorm. Also local smoke with a high of 28 and a humidex of 31. Saskatoon, few showers then clearing with a high of 27 and a humidex of 30. Calgary, mix of sun and clouds becoming sunny. We're expecting it to be hazy, becoming with widespread smoke. With a high of 27 and a humidex of 30. In Edmonton, mix of sun and clouds becoming sunny, high of 26 and a humidex of 29. Yellowknife, cloudiness increasing with a high of 20. Moving to Vancouver, sunny, high of 25 and a humidex of 28. In Victoria, sunny, high of 25 and a humidex of 29. And that was your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada.
Thank you very much, Nazreen. Nazreen, I was reading an article last night on CTV.ca about some of those weather conditions on the West Coast. Vancouver has not had a drop of rain since June the 15th. So we've been talking about these wildfires, the heat waves, the droughts. June 15th, since there's been a drop of rain in Vancouver. Can you imagine that?
I can't imagine that.
Yeah, by the ocean like that, typically you get a little bit of rain this time of year and not a drop in over a month. Nazreen, thank you for this.
Thank you.
That's Nazreen Abdel-Majid with your weather update. Coming up next, Michelle McQuigg of the Canadian Press will be here for the weekend news recap, and we'll discuss the Olympics. We'll have a little bit of an Olympics roundup. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. The Olympics are off and running. Canada has picked up a handful of medals during the opening weekend. While you were sleeping, Maggie McNeil picked up a gold medal in the pool, the first of the games for Canada. Also this morning, Jessica Klinkait picked up a bronze in judo, the first ever Canadian woman to medal in judo. This follows medals in synchronized diving in the 4x100 freestyle swimming relay over the weekend. Michelle McQuigg joins us now for the weekend news recap and a roundup of a couple Olympic stories that have made headlines. Michelle is the weekend news editor at the Canadian Press, and she joins us this morning. Hey, good morning, Michelle.
Good morning, Dave.
So, Michelle, let's start with some of the fun stuff here. What's your reaction to these awesome athletes bringing home some hardware?
It's super cool. I have to confess to a long-standing soft spot for the Olympics. I've always loved them. I know it's not necessarily like cool to like the Olympics these days in woke circles, but I've always loved it. And I always get a real charge out of watching the athletes and watching sports you don't normally get to observe. And huge congrats to all four winners so far, and may there be many, many more.
Mm-hmm. Agreed, all the way through. And Michelle, we'll get to some of the enjoyment side of this in a second, but there was a big story that began to murmur last week that really evolved over the weekend. So despite the women from Canada having success at these games thus far, there have been some concerns and controversies about compulsory uniforms that female athletes have to wear. The Norwegian beach handball team turned heads last week when they would not wear bikini bottoms. The German gymnastics team chose to wear non-traditional outfits. It was more of a long pants leotard than the typical bathing suit style you'll get with the women's gymnastics uniforms. There were also issues about the Egyptian beach volleyball team choosing not to wear bikini bottoms as well. Michelle, what do you make of this long overdue conversation about the objectification and sexualization of women's sports?
I think long overdue is quite right. And it's really interesting to watch it happen. And especially in the wake of the Me Too era, I suspect this kind of stuff might have started to play out last year, even if the games had gone ahead. Mm. It is really interesting to watch these issues play out. As you've said, there's been several examples, and there's actually another one that involved a Canadian athlete, not to do with uniforms, but again involving female equity in sport, which was interesting. Mandy Bougeau, who was a pretty decorated boxer mm-hmm. for Canada, because of COVID, of course, a lot of the traditional qualification events were shut down, and they were drawing upon scores that were posted during a specific season when she was on maternity leave. And she said, hey, that's not cool. I didn't get a chance to partake in this through no fault of my own. So she actually fought and was able to compete at the games. So that was another sort of win for women and equity in sport. Unfortunately, Mandy Bougeau's Olympic run has come to an end already as of yesterday. But this definitely does seem to be a time for a lot of broader conversations about the role women play in sports, especially, as you said, at a time when we've been seeing, not just in Canada, but elsewhere, a lot of women making a lot more noise in sport on the field and off, really.
Yeah, I definitely led the question by saying long overdue, putting it in that wording, but it is a long overdue conversation. I know that even when my niece was born back in the summer of 2016, my mom spent a lot of time watching the Olympics holding Aura in her arms and said, I want you to be an Olympic athlete one day, but not beach volleyball. I don't want you parading around in a bikini for people to objectify. So maybe we're having a little bit of fun there, but you know, I think it's definitely a good
way to go, Grandma Brown.
Yeah, way to go, Grandma Brown, all the way through and through. It makes no sense to me as to why female athletes can't just wear regular shorts while they're playing beach volleyball if they want to. You know, listen, if they want to wear a bikini, like rock and roll, but I don't see why they shouldn't be able to wear shorts as well. Like, make some choices here. Make some options available to people.
And you have a double standard going, too. I was reading about a Paralympic athlete, I believe also on a beach-oriented sport. I'm blanking on which one it was. But she was taken to task because her briefs were, quote, too short. So there's all kinds of mixed messaging and double standards at play here that could all just be simplified by giving women a choice.
Yeah, giving people choices. And like you can still have some standards, right? But you can say, like, these are your options inside the standards. Anyway.
As they do with most sports. There are all kinds of rules around, you know, in tennis, for instance, you only have X number of centimeters of white, you know, when you're playing of non-white material when you're playing Wimbledon, for instance. Mm-hmm. So that's fine. People can conform to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. For sure. Okay, Michelle, I've spoken over the last few weeks about how these Olympics have presented a bit of an ethical conundrum within me. More so than the usual IOC, public money for private profit concern, the pandemic looms heavily over these Olympics. Even just a few days in, are you feeling the same Olympic zeal?
Not quite, but I'm blaming more some of my own circumstances plus the time zone. I'm finding it hard to get into the swing of a good watching routine. So that's, I think, honestly, for me, that's probably more of a factor because if it aligned perfectly with my schedule, not going to lie, I'd probably be watching constantly. as it is, it's a bit more sporadic at the moment, but that's more of a scheduling thing. But you're right. You know, you do think about it. It is weird to see the smaller crowds, for instance. I'm sure the opening ceremonies, that striking image of the solo person on a stationary bike was a really cool way to acknowledge the times that we've just lived through and what's been going on. So I'm sure that does dampen excitement for a lot of people. Certainly in terms of logistics, it makes things much more challenging for all of those who are over in Tokyo, including all my colleagues.
Yeah.
So there's there's a lot to navigate. As you said, COVID-wise adds a whole other layer on top of other issues that people try to reckon with at Olympic time.
Yeah, the time zone thing definitely impacts me. I try not to be myopic about it because I understand that more than half the globe's population, this time zone is better for them. So it's
exactly,
not just about
right?
me. Like, it's not just about my Olympic enjoyment. But I will say the push notifications that I wake up to in the morning that serve as spoilers, I'm like, oh, no, not you.
Right? Yeah. The same reaction, but it also helps me know which events I really, really want to tune in for.
That's so, that too. That yeah. So it's a double-edged sword for sure. Okay, Michelle, let's get to our daily poll question, which I'm asking everybody today at AMI Audio on Twitter, Accessible Media Inc. on Facebook. If you could compete in any summer Olympic sport, Paralympic or Olympic, what would it be? Now we have some options there like track and field, water sports, cycling, gymnastics. But Michelle, this is an open-ended question. We're encouraging people to write in with whatever they might like. So what say you? What's a sport that you would want to compete in the summer games?
I'd want to be an open water swimming racer.
Oh. why the open water? Why the open water instead of the pool?
Because I don't love pools. Okay. That's why. lakes are my happy place. Obviously we're not in the lakes here, but I love open water. It would be also pretty rad bragging rights. Those guys are not messing around, open water racers.
Oh yeah, the open water swimmers, especially in Brazil when there was like sofas floating by, you know, like that's how you really.
Yeah,
that's
they're super hardcore. So that would be amazing bragging rights and I'd have a lot of fun.
So I gave this question a lot of thought. I was thinking about it all weekend long and I thought to myself, Dave, you have to know yourself as a person and an athlete to figure this out. So Michelle, I know a bunch of things about myself. One, tremendous performance anxiety. So something like the 100 meters or like a precision sport like diving, off the table because I would get in,
yeah,
I would get
okay.
in my head. I would totally mess up. But I do like the concept of running. So I was thinking to myself, well, what's a length of race that would allow you not to be totally paranoid about the starting gun or one single stumble that might throw you off? So I'm thinking that 100 is too short. Michelle, you read my mind. It's the 800 meter because that means like even if I'm a little slow out the blocks, I know that I can at least try to make that up. I also assume the training, although I'm sure rigorous, is not like trying to train for a marathon, right? You're not making me run 42 kilometers. I'm running 800 meters.
Yeah, it's clearly still a short distance run. Like
it's a run that I could do today. Probably not very fast, but I could do that today if I had to.
That sounds like a good plan.
I'm going to say, Michelle, it's all about self-awareness in these times that we live in.
Right.
Michelle, this was super fun today. Thank you for making a bit of time for us. We'll talk to you again for the news panel on Friday.
My pleasure. Talk to you soon.
That's Michelle McQuigg, the weekend news editor with the Canadian Press. Coming up next, digital accessibility specialist Didier Boudreau describes the accessibility shortcomings in the ESPN Fantasy Sports app. But first, here is Canadian Press reporter Karen Rebo with your morning business minute.
Stock markets in both Canada and the U.S. closed higher Friday. Toronto's TSX index gained 90 points to 20,188. New York's Dow Jones average surged 238 points to top 35,000 for the first time ever. And the Nasdaq jumped 152 points. In Tokyo this morning, the Nikkei index rose 285 points. And our dollar is trading overseas this morning at 79.49 cents U.S. The union representing Bombardier and de Havilland Aerospace workers in Toronto are threatening to hit the picket lines this week unless negotiations can guarantee Dash 8 turboprop jobs remain in the area when production resumes. After a three-week cooling off period, separate talks were set to restart today ahead of a Tuesday strike deadline. And a strike is underway by 900 Rio Tinto workers at the mining company's aluminum smelting facilities in Kitimat, BC. The union, also Unifor, had issued a 72-hour strike notice after nearly 7 weeks of negotiations. From the Canadian Press Business Desk, I'm Karen Rebo.
Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Let's continue our conversation about design and inclusion. Every now and then on the show, topics come up from my own meandering experience. And as a legally blind person, I run into my fair share of accessibility issues. Some of them roll off my shoulder, while others gnaw at me. The ones that do the gnawing are the ones that present themselves over and over and over again. Apps that I use every day certainly fall into that category, and digital accessibility specialist Denis Boudreau joins us now to hear out one of my gripes. Denis is the founder of Inclusive Communication and joins us from Montreal this morning. Hey, good morning, Denis. Great to chat with you once again.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So, Denis, you'll have to bear with me here because I'm going to walk through some issues that I've been having with the ESPN Fantasy Sports app. And we're going to be putting some images of screen grabs from my phone on screen. So I'll be describing them as we go. The first few picks are display settings on my phone. You'll see preferred font size and my preferred zoom. So my font size is certainly pretty big and my zoom is also pretty significant along the way. In my I keep my font size at the second biggest font. And then looking at the zoom setting, I keep my zoom setting right in the middle. I find that if I make the zoom any further than that, it really messes up the majority of my apps and turns my web browser into chaos. The other thing I want to note here is that I keep my phone in dark mode so that it's easier on my light sensitive eyes. Now let's look at one of the manifestations of how this ends up popping up on screen. We'll put up a picture here of my Gmail app. A lot of my apps accommodate these settings perfectly. We've got a screen grab here of my Gmail, the nice big font zoomed in nicely, and with the dark mode in full effect, it is perfection. So now we move over to an app that necessarily has been giving me some trouble. The next few picks come from the ESPN Fantasy app. You'll see how my dark mode, zoom, and font size not reflected at all. The font is tiny and the numbers are pretty much illegible for me. So then you think to yourself, okay, well, maybe you can fix this in the settings. So we go over to the settings page. The next picture is going to show the settings page on my ESPN app. You'll see there are no accessibility settings or display settings available at all. You get what you get. And I've been speaking with two other fantasy players who are both blind. They both experienced screen reader / voiceover issues inside the ESPN Fantasy app on their iPhones. So it's not just an Android problem or a Dave Brown problem either. The next picture is going to come from my preferred fantasy sports app, Yahoo. You'll see it's not perfect. My zoom and font size tend to blur the content a little bit, but irrespective, at least my preferred settings are reflected. I should mention we've interviewed Verizon's head of accessibility, Kasiah Timmons, about the steps Yahoo has taken to make their product more malleable for users, and they're pretty proud of the work that they do, and it was super cool chatting with Kasiah on the show a little while ago. Now we're coming back to the ESPN app. The last pick is back in the ESPN app. This one isn't necessarily a low vision issue as it is a usability issue. To sort stats, the button you press is teeny tiny. Yes, after tapping it about 5 or 6 times, you can make it function, but it's always a hassle, and that got me thinking about individuals who might have some motor issues. Now, Denis, you also did an audit of the ESPN app. What were some of your observations?
Where to begin? So I started actually looking at what you were saying about your two blind friends. So I turned on VoiceOver on iOS, which is a screen reader embedded into the device to listen to screens, like applications like this one, for instance. And most things just don't work. I can understand how your friends were saying that things weren't great. Being sighted and looking at what I would be missing if I was not like listening to everything, pretty much everything is not as it should be. Like, I'll give you a couple of examples. You have that setting button on the top right corner that you were talking about. That button is not even conveyed at all to someone with a screen reader, so they would not even know that there is a button there for them to go to settings. Not that it would matter all that much, of course, like, because what you said, you can't change anything for accessibility. But that was one. Speaking of buttons on the top left corner, for instance, same thing. There's a back button to go back a screen. That one is not picked up either, so you can't really go back through your navigation. You have to keep navigating through the different buttons that are there because you can't just go back to the previous screen that you were on. And speaking of those buttons, most of them on the screen are like, you'll hear what the text actually says, like stat or view or this or that, but you don't hear anything about that being a like an actionable control, like a link or a button, for instance. So you don't really know that you can activate those things or trigger those things to get to a different place. Images are not always described with proper description. You get descriptions like darklogo.png, which is a format for images, as opposed to getting the actual content of that particular button, which in that case was, I think, UFC Night Fight or something. The reading order through the app is also all out of whack. So you get to different places pretty much randomly. You're not following the order of the content. and so on and so forth. There were a couple of other things. Just looking at that from the screen, the voiceover or screen reader perspective. Well, and now, look. Well, okay, go ahead.
No, no, please, please, because I know you had some other observations as well from other accessibility issues.
Well, right, exactly. That's where I was going. So, and then I looked at what you were saying with low vision issues, for instance, and I could confirm everything that you said. So, not being able to set up anything the way that you would like it within the app, but maybe more importantly, all your own settings from your device not being transferred over to that app, which is really like one of the biggest flaws you can make when you're building an app for accessibility, because you want that app to be flexible and adaptable to the user's preferences. That you know, that's pretty much a baseline, but none of them are taken into consideration. So whether it's your dark mode preference, whether it's the font size, which is an obvious one, or something that you sort of alluded to, but this idea that as you make things bigger, that it would reflow in a way that would still work for you. And this is all basically due to not applying best practices for development. It's as simple as that. Sadly, it's as simple as that.
So, Denny, it kind of leads me into this question, and I think you alluded to it a little bit here, but why is it that some apps are designed to reflect preferred settings and some aren't?
It comes down to awareness, right? I mean, if the developers don't know about accessibility, of course they will not think about this because, you know, why would they? I think it's mostly that reason. If they have accessibility on their radar, if it's a consideration, if it's a requirement, then some of that get looped into their process. But if this is not something that they ever thought about, then we get examples like the ESPN Fantasy app where nothing is really made to be accessible.
So, Denny, if they are going to be so rigid in their aesthetic, which maybe sometimes I understand designers put a lot of time into these apps and they want to make them look good, why don't they have options in the settings to accommodate unique needs?
Well, you know, accessibility and aesthetics don't have to be a zero-sum game, right? Mm-hmm, they can work mm-hmm. together. We see that in so many different apps. Most big organizations the size of Disney or ESPN are very much aware about accessibility. So are these folks as well. For some reason, it didn't find its way into that particular app. But the reason why these settings are not in there is simply because, you know, if you don't think about it in the first place, if you don't plan for it in the first place, it's not going to find its way into your application. It comes down to awareness. It kind of reminds me of, you know, say the video industry, for instance. In the past couple of years, we've had a lot of improvements. Like, there's one game that comes to mind, The Last of Us Part II, which was, I think, the very first game that came out being completely accessible to people with disabilities, with a bunch of settings that you could sort of set to your own preferences. You know, like color blindness would be a very obvious one, but also having captions on everything and making sure that, you know, you could use the controls in different ways so that you weren't stuck with using the controller that you normally would have with your Xbox or your PlayStation. So there were a bunch of features in there. So it's slowly getting into the culture of games or applications in general, but we're still not completely there, as you can see with that particular one.
Denny, I know this question might be a little bit controversial, but does it surprise you that a company like ESPN, which is owned by a behemoth like Disney, just has such a woeful app when it comes to accessibility?
It doesn't. It really doesn't. I wish I could say that it did, because, you know, the norm would be that apps are accessible, but, you know, the vast majority of them are not. So what is most surprising, I'd say, is that coming from an organization like Disney, like sitting at the top of this, and how they're very much aware of accessibility and lawsuits. I mean, if you do a quick Google search on Disney and accessibility lawsuit, you might find a couple links in there. So it's not as if they've never heard of this before. And yet somehow it finds its way into certain areas of their business, but not others. So it goes back to what I was saying at the beginning. It's a question of really, you know, insisting on the importance of applying accessibility standards to your process, your project. And that particular team or that particular group in general, understanding the benefits of accessibility, because really I think that's what needs to be be worth being reminded in this case. I mean, when you think about lawsuits, like in last year alone, there were over 3,500 lawsuits in the United States. So companies like Disney or like bigger players were, a lot of them were in there, some of them being sued more than once over the course of the year. Mm. So like, why does it surprise me? Not really. But at the same time, yes, because you'd think that by now they would take this seriously. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of reasons. I mean, just think about, like, you know, we've talked about some of these things before. The idea that, you know, like Americans with disability, because we're talking like the American public here, but I can also translate to Canada. But, you know, Americans, like 26% of the population of the United States having a disability, and that particular demographic controlling over $490 billion a year in terms of after-tax disposable income, you'd think that that's a good market to tap into. Mm-hmm. And then when you think about Canada, that's $55 billion, according to the Ontarian Chamber of Commerce, and we're talking 22% of the population on average.
Yeah.
So you'd think that this is a market that is worth investing into.
Denny, there might be a few people who are watching or listening this morning who are scoffing at this, saying, ah, it's just fantasy sports. Does it really matter? I know this question might be a little bit leading, but do you have a reflection on why digital inclusion matters, whether it's access to something like a government website, online banking, booking a vacation, or in this case, playing fantasy sports?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, who would we be to, you know, decide what is worth, what can someone access or doesn't access, basically, right? So if someone finds joy and happiness in using that particular app or playing that particular type of game, I think it's as important in terms of their well-being and their ability to be empowered to do what they feel is right than online banking is. I mean, we've seen, especially this past year, I mean, when we think back, not as if it was over yet, but thinking back of last year with the pandemic and when we started shifting over to a lot of virtual and online out of necessity, I know so many people who all of a sudden were completely cut out of services that to which they were already hanging by a thread. Mm. So I'm thinking groceries, for instance, like grocery shopping. When we were not able to go to the grocery store anymore, and you could not ask your neighbor anymore to do so, to do that for you, and you had to turn to an online service instead, and the service wasn't accessible, I personally know people who went for weeks and weeks without any fresh food, any fresh produce or anything like that, and they had to feed on canned goods because there was no way for them to get anything like that. People who missed on their own, their house payments because they were not able to go to the bank, and then they the online banking wasn't accessible for them, that sort of thing. So, you know, we understand that this is important, but especially in a context where there's all this stress and, you know, games are made to release that tension, not being able to play the game that you want to play with your friends or something that you like or you enjoy, I think is another pretty, cruel way to remind people that they don't belong, that they don't matter as much as others do. And it really comes down to that awareness piece again, as I was saying at the beginning, like to make a change there.
Denny, we always appreciate your expertise and perspective. Thank you so much for making time for us today and dealing with one of my personal gripes.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you.
And that does serve as a reminder that if you have a personal digital inclusion gripe, please feel free to reach out to the show and let us know about it. Maybe we can pass it by Denise's desk as well. So send us emails, feedback@ami.ca, feedback@ami.ca, or you can always pick up the phone and give us a phone call, 1-866-509-4545, 1-866-509-4545. Let's bring in Mike Ross and get to the big business story of the day. Mike, some labor concerns really taking the forefront in regard to the business these days.
Yeah, a couple of big stories today, Dave. The union representing Bombardier and De Havilland aerospace workers in Toronto are threatening to hit the picket lines this week unless negotiations can guarantee the Dash 8 turboprops remain in the area when production resumes. This after a three-week cooling-off period, and separate talks were set to restart today ahead of tomorrow's strike deadline. Unifor National President Jerry Dias says the negotiations are about protecting highly skilled advanced manufacturing jobs. about 2,200 members of Unifor Locals 112 and 673 at Toronto's Downview plant manufacture Bombardier's global business aircraft and, until recently, Dash 8 turboprops for de Havilland. The talks come as the aviation sector is taking steps to recover from government-forced shutdowns of international commercial travel because of COVID-19. Also, a strike already underway by 900 Rio Tinto workers at the mining company's aluminum smelting facilities in Kitimat, B.C. The union had issued a 72-hour strike notice after nearly 7 weeks of negotiations, and bargaining continued right up until the early Sunday strike deadline. Jerry Dias, once again from Unifor, saying the walkout is about what he calls Rio Tinto's greed and lack of respect for union members. The company said earlier it was committed to working with the union to reach a mutually beneficial outcome. So Unifor, rather busy these days, and looks like it'll continue to be so.
Mike, thank you for this. I really wonder how many conference calls a day Jerry Dias finds himself on. Oh my goodness, it's got to be a lot.
It does. And there's a great documentary out there that CBC did on the Unifor's involvement in trying to save the union jobs at the GM plant in Oshawa about 3 years ago. If you can dig that up, CBC put that together. We watched it not too long ago. And lots of Jerry Dias in there, certainly lots of union workers, lots of Canadian manufacturers. Manufacturing union jobs that went away.
Really, really important topic. Mike, thank you for bringing it to us.
Okay, Dave.
That's Mike Ross with the big business story of the day. He'll be back in a couple of minutes with the regional news update. But coming up next, film reviewer Amy Amante will share her thoughts on the Netflix docuseries Penguin Town. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Before we get into this edition of AMI at the Movies, let's have a quick watch and listen to a trailer clip of the Netflix docuseries, Penguin Town.
There are a lot of movies about penguins. Then there's these birds.
A penguin slips off a rock and falls in the water.
Meet the endangered African penguin.
They waddle clumsily down a beach.
Every summer, they descend on Simonstown, South Africa. These birds are taking over this town.
They loiter in streets and homes
with full VIP access. In this place, they are gods.
A penguin shakes water off.
They have 6 months to choose a partner.
They court,
stake a claim,
fall downstairs,
and make more penguins.
And nurse chicks.
Sounds easy enough, right?
Amy Amante is our film reviewer and joins us this morning from Vancouver, BC. Also, the host of the AMI original podcast, Accessing Art with Amy. Hey, good morning, Amy.
Hey, good morning, Dave. Did that put a little smile on your face this morning?
100% put a smile on my face. I love penguins. I love nature docuseries. I love nature documentaries. Amy, that voice sounds so darn familiar. But who is the narrator of this series?
Oh, well, if you recognize the voice, rightly so, it's Patton Oswalt, who I think, you know, is known for comedy work, but also King of Queens. He was big on the King of Queens. That was the first time I ever experienced his comedy. And I just think he's like this joyful, bubbly kind of, you know, effervescent person. So it really comes through in this documentary.
Yeah, he also has a supporting role in an NBC show that's now available on Canadian Netflix called AP Bio that I may have binged an entire season of yesterday.
Ooh.
So yeah, definitely a very, very distinct voice. Definitely some comedic stylings there. A bit of whimsy in the style of that narration for the docuseries. Now, some critics have actually said the docuseries might be a bit of a slight mockery of an endangered species. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, I think the reason that was brought up was simply because there is a narrative to this piece, as you may have caught already by listening to the introduction. So as listeners, you know, there's really two kind of styles of these types of, you know, animal documentaries. So one is this very National Geographic what we're used to, the very sort of scientific lens, right? Where you get a lot of facts and a lot of figures, and it's like you're spying on the wild. And then there's this type of series, which has a storytelling narrative. And so the storytelling narrative brings us into a place where, you know, we're anthropomorphizing these characters, right? We're looking at them as almost if they're human beings, and so we can relate to them differently. And I think the reason the criticism came about this mockery is because of this type of narrative, because it kind of maybe doesn't put the same sort of air quotes serious lens on the fact that this is an endangered species. However, I think there's room for both types of documentaries in this genre, right? So, but I think that's where that sort of stemmed from.
I'm going to come back to the word I used before, whimsy. Do you think a bit of whimsy in the narrative storytelling can actually serve the audience?
Absolutely. I think, you know, one of the things for me in watching these types of documentaries is that, you know, again, when I refer to National Geographic as there being a lens, sometimes, like a scientific lens, sometimes I'm so interested and I'm so fascinated, but I feel all this pressure to have to remember all the details, right? So I can I can tell somebody about this amazing thing that I learned, right? But when you're watching a series like this that's created with this storytelling narrative, we've got, you know, these penguins that are referred to by names like couples. They're referred to as husband and wives, and we're following, you know, the Culvert family, and, you know, so you get this sort of relationship building with these animals. And I think what happened for me is I tended to learn things through osmosis, through this like really simplified process. So here's a fun fact for you, Dave. Do you know what they call, I'm going to use the word flock. It's not a flock of penguins, but a flock of penguins in the ocean is referred to as what? Do you know?
I have no clue.
It's a raft.
A raft of penguins.
Never knew, right? And so that, for whatever reason, is like sticking in my mind like glue. Whereas if I had been bombarded with 1,000 facts, I probably wouldn't have been able to retain that.
Amy, do you know what a group of pugs is called? The dog breed pugs when they get together in a group? It's called a grumble. A grumble of pugs. Which absolutely makes sense if you've ever spent any time around a pug. Amy, the series does come with a parental guidance, which maybe confused me a little bit here. Does that have to do with penguin lovemaking? Is this a family-friendly film?
I think it, you know, again, I would say yes. It's very much a family-friendly film. There are going to be things, you know, anytime you watch these kind of series, there's always a predator-prey kind of element.
Oh, those seals and orca whales.
So I will just say that, you know, not all of our penguin friends survive this series. And so there are a few kind of dark moments, again, told through this narrative, right? And you like your heart breaks, right? Because Papa Penguin's waiting for Mama Penguin to come on home and she doesn't.
Oh, dear.
And you don't know what happens, right? And so, you know, so there is some of that. And yes, there is some of the making babies talk that happens. So I think, you know, I think creators just thought that they needed to provide that lens for parents just in case they hadn't had the talk of either death or life.
For our clip there, we had our boss, Andy Frank, do some of the description for the trailer. But how was the description in the film itself?
Yeah, you know, what's really nice about a piece that has a storytelling narrative is that there's this combination of integrated description that's already created without us even recognizing, because somebody's telling a story.
Yeah.
You know, so we're being introduced to these penguins and we're introduced them as characters and we're talking about how they build nests. And so I don't actually need the description, and it's not in the description, to tell me how that's done because the narration is doing that. And so where the description comes in is in spots where it just, like, rightly so, fills in the small amount of visuals that I would be missing out, like the penguin sliding down the rock. Because that's a bit of a comical moment when you think about the fact that these penguins literally, like, throw themselves out of the ocean, land on these slippery rocks, and do this, like, you know, comedy circus type maneuver to try and climb up them, where there's a perfectly good beach right next to the, right there. They're choosing things the hard way, I think.
Well, sometimes you got to earn those fish that you're going to find your way to if you're That's a penguin. Right. Amy, was there something about this docuseries that really resonated with you at a personal level?
Yeah, you know, I, like you, Dave, I love the idea of these animal series. I think it's one of the greatest ways for human beings to learn about not only the environment, but the relationships that we have between humans and animals. And one of the things that I thought really resonated for me with this one was actually that relationship. So again, when we look at National Geographic, we are the witness to the wild, right? When we look at something like this, these penguins are integrated into Simonstown. And so they rightly show, and there was a great scene in the trailer there that shows a couple of the penguins that are looking for a place to nest amongst the other 1,000 penguin couples that show up on this in this town every year, walking through somebody's home, looking for a place to nest. Now, it was really remarkable to see this particular piece, but also remarkable because in the storytelling narrative, it is made obvious to us that the homeowners, even though we don't actually see them, have left the front door and the back door open on purpose.
Oh, wow.
To allow for the penguins to sort of come and go and do their nesting. Because they know they're going to be there for this period of 6 months. And once you know you got a penguin nesting in your backyard with a family, you kind of have to leave your doors open because they can't eat.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I thought that relationship between humans and animals, it was something that really resonated with me because this town has been so respectful mm-hmm. of these penguins and just letting them do what they need to do.
Oh, Amy, I love that so much. Mm-hmm. Okay, we've got to be a little quick here, Amy, because I've got a news story that I need to play before the hour wraps
right.
up. But how would you rate the series out of 10?
I gave it a 10.
A solid slam dunk Amy rating there. Amy, always a pleasure chatting. Thank you so much for making time for us today.
Happy Monday, Dave.
That's Amy Amanti, our film reviewer in Vancouver, BC. Today she reviewed the docuseries Penguin Town, which you can find on Netflix. Just as we're wrapping up the hour, I've got one news story that I need to play for you. Mary Simon will be installed today as Canada's 30th Governor General. Terry Pedwell looks ahead.
Will formally take over as Governor General at a ceremony being held in the Senate. Afterwards, she'll return to the Governor General's official residence, where, as Commander-in-Chief of Canada, she'll receive military honors from the Governor General's Foot Guards. While Simon will be installed as the first Indigenous person to take on the mostly ceremonial post, she begins her tenure with questions being raised about whether she was the right pick. The Office of the Commissioner of Official Languages has received hundreds of complaints from Canadians upset that Simon cannot speak French. Simon is Inuk and was educated in a federal day school in the Nunavut region of Quebec, but she says she was not given the opportunity to learn French as a child. Terry Pedro, The Canadian Press, Ottawa.
Those ceremonies are going to be getting underway in just a couple of moments. Very neat that our friends over at CBC are going to be doing a simulcast in multiple languages, including French, English, and several Indigenous languages as well. Coming up after the break, we'll get the regional news update and a sports chat with Jeff Ryman. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI Audio and AMI TV. I'm Dave Brown. It's Monday, July the 26th, 2021. Coming up in the second hour of the show, Mark Aflalo of Double Tap Canada will tell you about Too Good To Go, an anti-waste food app that recently launched in Toronto. And Jim Crisco will give you the Western Regional Report. He describes Saskatchewan's commitment to a new skills training program. Excellent stuff coming your way over the course of the next hour, but let's begin by handing things over to Mike Ross in the regional news update.
Thanks, Dave. We'll begin in British Columbia, where an expert says a combination of drought, heat, and drier fuels is causing larger areas to burn in British Columbia. Kyra Hoffman, a postdoctoral researcher with UBC's Faculty of Forestry, says climate change is also expected to create longer wildfire seasons because of more drought, which leads to drier trees and grasses. She says all of this leads to longer fire seasons and more area burned, even though there are fewer blazes. The BC Wildfire Service says the province has seen over 4,000 square kilometers scorched so far, which is about four times the year-to-date averages over 5 and 10 years. And an emergency room doctor who's seen firsthand the health impacts of prolonged exposure to wildfire smoke says the situation is likely to get worse in the future. Dr. Courtney Howard says it was harder than usual to treat people who showed up at the emergency department in Yellowknife with symptoms of asthma as wildfires and smoke swept across the Northwest Territories in the summer of 2014. While the cumulative health impacts of exposure to wildfire smoke have not been thoroughly studied, Howard says hints can be drawn from the link between disease, death, and air pollution in general. She says the pollution increases death from the conditions that kill Canadians the most: stroke, heart disease, cancer, and chronic respiratory diseases. To the Prairies, and police in Winnipeg have identified a man who was found critically injured outside a home over the weekend. They say 20-year-old Tyler McKay of Winnipeg was rushed to hospital after police responded to a report of an assault early Saturday, but he did not survive. Police say their homicide unit is now investigating, and they're asking anyone with information that could help with the case to contact them. Ontario next, and that province has now administered nearly 19 million doses of COVID-19 vaccines. The daily case numbers continue to hold fairly steady with under 200 new infections a day. The province reported 172 new cases of COVID yesterday. No new cases were reported among residents or healthcare workers in long-term care homes. There are 127 people in intensive care units with critical COVID-related illness, and 81 people are on ventilators. And finally, in the Atlantic region, Nova Scotia Progressive Conservative leader Tim Houston is hitting the trail again as the campaign for the 41st general election hits its second week. Houston is expected to make an announcement about housing today. This comes after the Tory candidate promised rural Nova Scotians on Sunday that repairs to old, neglected roads, if his party were to form election or were to form government after the next election, would be taken care of. Over the weekend, fellow candidate, NDP leader Gary Burrell, promised to end street checks by police. And Liberal leader Ian Rankin announced more funding for rural fire departments in the event of a Liberal win next month. That election is slated to take place on August 17th. And those are your top regional headlines going coast to coast across the country.
Thank you very much, Mike. That's Mike Ross. He's our news director. Jeff Ryman is our sports reporter, so we should have ourselves a sports chat. So, Jeff, of course, there's lots going on in the world of sports. Michelle McQuiggan and I took a closer look at the Olympics in the last hour. And before we leave, Jeff, I am going to ask you our daily poll question about which sport you'd want to compete in the Summer Games. But baseball fans right here in Toronto in Canada watching their Blue Jays flounder a little bit, fluttering, going into a big series with the Boston Red Sox starting tonight.
Yeah, they're all over the place here, Dave. It's kind of it's been a mess to watch the last couple of weeks for the Blue Jays, where, you know, they win a couple, then they lose a couple, and now they're, you know, in a little bit of a tailspin. I think they've only won one of their last five games, and now they go into division rival and, of course, the AL leading Boston Red Sox for four games at Fenway. So that's always fun. And that's always going to be a huge challenge for the Toronto Blue Jays. So, Dave, not necessarily the easiest last couple of weeks for the Blue Jays. And I believe they're 4.5 games out of the wild card position in the AL. So, I mean, they're not out of it. They're still there. And the trade deadline is coming up at the end of the week. But, yeah, they've got a lot of ground to make up, and it doesn't get very easy against those Boston Red Sox.
Yeah, Boston's tough. Last time we spoke about the Jays last week, they were going up against Canadian Nick Pivetta pitching for the Bo Sox. He'll be pitching again tonight for the Red Sox against the Jays. So he's always a tough out on any given night, and he always seems to bring it a little bit extra when he plays against Canada's team, as they're sometimes identified, although, as I've mentioned before, I'm a Red Sox fan, so maybe I don't fall inside that Canada's team spectrum. Jeff, how big a week is this for the Jays? The trade deadline's at the end of the week. If they drop 3 or 4 against Boston, or dare I say even get the brooms busted out of them, get out and get swept, what are the odds they decide just to do nothing at the deadline and sort of let this team keep playing it out?
Yeah, you know what, Dave? I think that's going to be the golden question. How close can they get to a playoff spot? I feel like you're always going to want to bolster your roster. Like I mentioned, 4.5 games out isn't too far. I feel like they can make a decent push. And we saw it, I think, last year. I mean, the Blue Jays had a huge second half of the season. So it's not like it's out of the realm of possibility for the Blue Jays to finally start get going and getting on a roll. We're starting to see it a little bit. And we saw glimpses of the George Springer that the Blue Jays fans have so wanted the last couple of weeks and months. Obviously, that got off to a rocky start at the beginning of the season, but he made that outstanding catch over the weekend in center field. He's hitting home runs. His batting average is slowly climbing up. You know, players like that, I think you're really waiting to see what George Springer can give you, and now he's really coming to fruition and obviously batting in that leadoff spot. So the Blue Jays, I feel like, have a lot more to give, but we've been saying that all season long. The pitching, Dave, the pitching seems to be the real issue here. Mm-hmm. Either, you know, one of the starters has, you know, a flub of a game, or of course,
or falls,
the bullpen
falls down a flight of stairs.
Yeah, no kidding, Dave. I mean, one of the biggest rivals for the Toronto Blue Jays, those dreaded stairs. Alek Manoah was slated to get the start today. He's not able to go, apparently, after he fell down the dugout stairs. And of course, Robbie Ray was holding his kid earlier in the season, fell down some stairs and missed a couple of games. So got to watch out for those stairs. Take the elevator or escalator maybe for the Toronto Blue Jays. But I feel like, you know, maybe adding a good, decent starter into that rotation could really help things out. You know, looking at the back half of that, of the starting rotation, Steven Matz, Ross Stripling, been up and down, a little bit shaky here and there throughout the entire season. I think maybe adding a person who can, you know, slate into that middle of the rotation there in terms of starters would be beneficial. A couple of names that I think I'm looking at: Jose Berrios out in Minnesota, in John Gray as well in Colorado.
Yeah.
I think those guys, I mean, they'll cost you a pretty penny, but I feel like those are the types of guys that you can sort of just slot in to that middle of that starting rotation and just leave them. And, you know, if you can get some longevity out of that in terms of in-game play, if they can go 6-7 innings and minimize the usage of the bullpen, I think that could bode really well for the Toronto Blue Jays. Consistency is key here,
yeah,
Dave. I think they need to go out and get some consistent players and, you know, eventually package that all together and be a consistent ball club.
That's the big thing for baseball in general over the 162-game season. It's about consistent play, not just the surges here and there. Jeff, you mentioned some inconsistency in the pitching. Season debut today for 26-year-old Tom Hatch is going to be opening the game in Fenway, which not his major league debut. He played a couple games last year in 2020, but definitely tough for a 26-year-old to walk in into the middle of the season and play a game against those big bats of the Boston Red Sox. And Jeff, I do like your idea of making a deal with Colorado. There's even a potential to go try and attract John Gray and maybe even bring in a player like Daniel Bard to bolster the bullpen, as well as Colorado is out of the mix out there in the NL West in the National League. So it's possible they could swing a big, big deal with Colorado and address a couple concerns at once. Jeff, before I let you go, I do want to ask you our daily poll question, which folks can find at AMI Audio on Twitter, Accessible Media Inc. on Facebook. If you could compete in any Summer Olympic or Paralympic sport, which one would it be? Now, Jeff, we've got the general options here, but we're always so encouraging people to sort of get in with their specific event. So the options we have are track and field, water sports, cycling, gymnastics. But Jeff, if you could pick to compete in one specific sport, what would it be?
They have so many different options. I'm a water baby, so I think a swimming sport would be pretty cool. I mean, you know, some sort of swimming relay.
Mm-hmm.
But Dave, I'm going to go with one of the newer sports in skateboarding. I love skateboarding. I love watching it. I think it's about time. It's finally in the Olympics. I would have to go with skateboarding. I'm pretty into those extreme sports. Whenever they're on TV, I just get sucked into watching those. And of course, growing up, I think a lot of people my age and in my generation loved playing Tony Hawk Pro Skater. And I fell in love with skateboarding. I haven't done it in a while, but I went through a skateboarding phase when I was a little bit younger. So I would have to go with skateboarding, Dave.
I like that answer from Jeff Ryman, and it was my generation, too. We also played the Tony Hawk, so there is finally some crossover generationally between me and Jeffy on this one. Hey, Jeff, always fun, man. Have a great day. Enjoy the baseball. Enjoy the Olympics. Enjoy everything else that's going on, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you, Dave.
That's Jeff Ryman. He is at the AMI Sports Desk. Nazreen Abdel-Majid is at the AMI Weather Desk.
Thanks, Dave. Here is your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada. In Corner Brook, mainly sunny, cloudiness increasing, fog patches dissipating with a high of 24, except a high of 20 along parts of the coast and a humidex of 28. Charlottetown, mix of sun and clouds with a chance of showers. There's a risk of a thunder shower, fog patches dissipating with a high of 26 and a humidex of 32. St. John, mainly cloudy with a chance of showers and a risk of a thunder shower, high of 22, except a high of 17 along parts of the coast and a humidex of 28. In Quebec City, mix of sun and clouds, 60% chance of showers or thunderstorms with local smoke, a high of 24 and a humidex of 31. In Toronto, sunny, then a mix of sun and clouds with a chance of showers, high of 31 and a humidex of 34. Beach weather. I like that. Sault Ste. Marie, mainly sunny, local smoke with a high of 27 and a humidex of 31. Brandon, a mix of sun and clouds with a chance of showers and a risk of thunderstorm and hazy with a high of 30 and a humidex of 33. Regina, sunny, then a mix of sun and clouds with a chance of showers, high of 29 and a humidex of 32. And Lethbridge, sunny, then hazy, becoming widespread smoke, high of 32 and a humidex of 35. In Red Deer, mainly cloudy with a chance of showers, then clearing and hazy with a high of 26 and a humidex of 29. Moving to Whitehorse, mainly cloudy, chance of showers changing to a 70% chance of showers. There's a risk of a thunderstorm, high of 19. In Kelowna, sunny, local smoke with a high of 34. And in Vancouver, sunny, high of 25 and a humidex of 28. And that was your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada.
Thank you very much, Nazreen. Coming up next, Mark Aflalo of Double Tap Canada will tell you about Too Good To Go, an anti-waste food app that recently launched in Toronto. But first, cyber attacks are becoming more frequent. How will they change in the future? Here's Chuck Sievertson with Tech Trends.
Jason Crabtree is a former senior advisor to U.S. Army Cyber Command. He says the reason we've seen so many cyber attacks in recent months has to do with how dependent we've become on our technology.
Technology is now a fundamental part of how our businesses and government agencies operate and deliver services. So we shouldn't be surprised that we're seeing more risk and we're seeing more disruptions because we've become more dependent.
According to a research study by Deep Instinct, ransomware attacks increased by over 400% in 2020 over the year before. But Crabtree says he's concerned about the next evolution of cyber hacking.
If we're not successful at defending our networks, not just from data breaches, which is what we all used to talk about, not just from availability, which is what we're talking about with ransomware, that's why people are paying attention, but also data integrity. You don't want your bank balance changed.
With Tech Trends, Chuck Sievertson, ABC News.
Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI Audio and AMI TV. Let's talk tech with Mark Aflalo from Double Tap TV. Earlier this month, an anti-waste food app called Too Good To Go launched in Toronto. To talk about this further is Mark Aflalo. He's one of the co-hosts of Double Tap TV, which you can find on AMI TV Tuesdays at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. And Mark joins us this morning from Montreal. Hey, good morning, Mark. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing wonderful. You?
I'm doing well. So, Mark, this is a really important topic. Beyond being a good, important technological story, it's just generally an important social cause as well. And I gave sort of the one-liner, not even the elevator pitch of what the Too Good To Go app is. So give us a bit more detail on what it's all about.
It's a pretty cool initiative. I mean, this is a service that's been around for the past couple of months worldwide, but is now only coming to Toronto. Basically, they're trying to fight food waste. And how do you do that when you're a food waste app? Well, they're connecting individuals like you and me with different restaurants that are looking to save their footprint on, and they're, you know, the creation of emissions and greenhouse gas emissions. If you look at the details, the facts are that each year, one-third of food produced in the world goes to waste, which represents about 8% of all greenhouse gas emissions. So by connecting consumers with restaurants who are trying to obviously do their bid to be a bit more sustainable and not waste, and to those who want to actually help contribute to that, the app connects the two of them.
So how does that process work? I've got some bananas going bad on my counter. I call up Jack Astor's and I say, guys, I've got bananas. Or how does this work? Is it a little more complex than that?
A little bit more complex than that. It's mostly the restaurants who, at the end of a night, have a lot of food waste going on, whether it's food that wasn't eaten. It was mostly things that are prepared or meat that's out that they don't want to freeze and stuff like that. They will actually prepare these surprise bags of food, normally include some kind of protein with some kind of side, maybe even some kind of dessert. And they'll make them available on this app for people who want to buy them at extremely discounted cost. We're talking about at least a quarter of the cost of buying regular food. And if you are interested in actually getting one of those bags, you can actually pop by the store and pick it up, make the purchase in the app, and you two are connected. And what happens is you've made yourself a nice good meal with at a fraction of the cost, and you've, you know, contributed to help saving that food. And the restaurants don't have all the stuff going in the garbage. They're not feeding the rats out in the alley anymore. They're actually taking this meat and stuff that might have been, you know, defrosted or fresh. You know, a lot of restaurants, you know, cook fresh, right? So they have meat that comes in the morning, and they underestimated, they overestimated, so they got a left. Got a leftover, so now they're going to do something with that and make money off it, whereas they wouldn't have made money on it before. It would have been gone to waste, obviously contributing to all the waste that we talked about, and instead they are actually putting it to good use.
As you mentioned, Mark, this is something that recently launched in Toronto. You also mentioned that it's an international initiative. Tell us a bit more about the sort of range and scope they're looking for here in regards to their reach.
Okay, right now the app has more than 40 million active users in 15 international markets. It's called Too Good To Go, and it's helped save more than 82 million meals since 2016 when it actually launched. So coming to Toronto, they've partnered with nearly 100 different partners and restaurants in Toronto, and the ones they highlighted most recently are Eataly, Greenhouse, and Fresh City. And those companies specifically were chosen because of their commitments to sustainable practices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to ask more about those relationships, because obviously to make this work, you need buy-in not just from people who want to buy deeply discounted meals, but from the restaurants who are actually producing the extra food, producing what would typically be the food waste.
Exactly. The restaurants, you know, obviously have to have some kind of, listen, there are restaurants that say, okay, whatever, this is just part of our business, so we're going to throw this food aside.
Yeah, it's a sunk cost.
Exactly. But if you actually look at it and say, okay, wait a second, we can do our part for the environment, we can help people who may not be able to afford food at its retail cost. And we can take all this food that we know we're going to have at the end of the day. And instead of throwing it in the garbage, literally, that's money thrown away, money burnt. They can turn that into something that helps somebody, helps the environment, and helps themselves and their bottom line at the end of the day.
How are you when it comes to making sure the food in the fridge and the food in the counters end up going to use by the end of the week? I'm pretty good, Mark, but there are some vegetables that sneak by me by the end of the week.
You know, the biggest challenge I have, and I've noticed this lately because the kids have been home, obviously, for quite some time over the past couple of years, is not really the waste and things that we overbuy. Yes, there's the odd, the odd banana or apple that goes awry.
Bananas because, go too fast. That's like my deepest conspiracy theory. It's like I bought a bushel of six or whatever for the week for my smoothies, and by Saturday, it's all rotten.
Here's the biggest challenge I see. You know, we've made this shift towards delivery and or curbside pickup because we didn't want to, you know, have much contact with people. By doing that, I feel there's a lack of quality control over the products that we get, especially produce. When you buy, you know, you buy the apples that you want to buy, and not only that, but you want to check expiry dates. And that's where I see the waste happening, is getting a bunch of eggs and realizing 4 days in, oh, these expired yesterday. Well, why, if I went into the grocery store and bought that, I would have made sure that this expires in 3 months from now, not 2 days from now. And I think that, you know, I'm not laying any blame here, not naming any names, but I think they might be taking advantage of us a little bit on this whole curbside and this delivery element, which is why we're going back into stores more and more to eliminate that waste.
Yeah, I've had a few people tell me stories about how they would buy the milk online from a couple different grocery retailers, and the milk would arrive, and, you know, it would be a week's worth of milk. It would be 6 to 8 liters, and the expiry date was the next day. And they were like, what am I supposed to do with 8 liters of milk today?
Well, you could bake a lot.
You could do a ton of baking.
You could feed the neighborhood's cats.
You could do a ton of baking. Yeah, I definitely feel the same way about that one as well, Mark. Trusting sort of other people to pick out your stuff. Again, I'm a single operation in my household, and I tend to get one of those things of arugula or baby spinach for the week.
Yeah.
And one of the grocery pickers brought me one of the ones with the pink sticker on it that says, oh, it's 50% off. It's going to expire tomorrow. I'm like,
why?
This is useless to me. Why'd you get me this thing with the pink sticker? Now, again, I did not give the guy one star. He still got his 5 stars. I didn't file an official complaint because the last thing I want to do is get some guy in trouble, right? Like some guy who's working like for less than minimum wage for a corporate tech giant while they get huge profits while he gets nothing. The last thing I'm going to do is like try to bury this guy. But, you know, I just buried him on air on national TV.
There you go. Well, you have mission accomplished, Dave.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Speaking of national TV, what's coming up on Double Tap TV tomorrow night?
This is, you know what, it's a fun episode because it's technically our last of this I Quote Your Finger season, but I mean, we're on every single week, so you're going to see a couple okay. interesting town halls and reruns throughout the summer. But this is a Ask Us Anything episode. We're giving you the opportunity. We're going through our mailbag. We have so many questions that have gone unanswered, but we're going to get to those. Sean Priest is joining us. Mitchell Whitfield is joining us. And we're going to be going hands on. We're going to do rapid fire to make sure we get to all these questions. And we're gonna go out with season 3 with style. But don't worry, more episodes are in the works. Recording a lot of stuff going on. We've got an exciting season 4 coming up for you guys.
Love that. ADTA, Ask Double Tap Anything. That's what we're talking about right there.
I like it.
Speaking of that, Mark, getting in the theme of that, before I let you go, I want to ask you the daily poll today, which is about the Olympics. So I'm asking everybody today, if you could compete in any Summer Olympic or Paralympic sport, what would it be? Now, I've got some broad categories here, but I want you to kind of pick a specific one. So the broad categories are track and field, water sports, cycling, or gymnastics. Mark, what say you? What's an Olympic sport that you would want to compete in the Summer Games?
I would love to have the ability to control my body in a way that I could synchronize swim.
Oh, yeah. That one, that's not just the body control, that's the breathing control, too. You put my head underwater for like 3 seconds, I'm freaking out.
I'm done after 3 seconds, too. So, yeah, I'd like to have that agility. I'd like to have that control over myselfness to be able to synchronize swim. Even just a car wheel or something. Yeah. Now, the image of myself in a Speedo and a nice one piece is absolutely gorgeous for my, you know, the listeners and the viewers out there. But yeah, that's what I want.
Well, just wait till we do the Men of AMI calendar. It's going to be a hot seller. Going to sell like hotcakes once we do that. Yeah, that's a pirate theme 1 month for sure. Mark, all the best talking to you. Have yourself a great day and we'll talk to you again. Not next week because it's civic holiday here in Ontario. Not a holiday in Quebec, though. Sorry, your Saint-Jean-Baptiste cancels you out from the August holiday.
Okay, I'll survive. Okay.
I'm sure you will. That's Mark Aflalo. He's the co-host of Double Tap TV, and he joined us from Montreal, Quebec, where, again, there is no long weekend this weekend because they get their Saint-Jean-Baptiste earlier in the summer, but a lot of Canada gets themselves a long weekend. So a regular week this week on Now with Dave Brown, but headed into a long weekend. So I think you might already hear the joy in my voice. It's a possibility, maybe, conceivably, just sort of. Coming up after the break, we'll get to the accessibility story roundup. We'll get a report on entertainment from Nazreen Abdel-Majid. She'll also share what's trending. Mike Ross will remind you what happened this day in history. And then I'm going to ask Ramya Amuthan what Olympic sport she would want to compete in. Lots of fun coming your way on Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. This song, giving off island vibes. We're going to switch things up a little bit here, though, because as you know, there's a special sound we have for the accessibility story roundup. Hee-haw! Heading over to a little bit more of a Western cowboy aesthetic. Yeah. We wear multiple faces here on Now with Dave Brown. Let's get to the article, which is entitled, "This Induction Stovetop Uses Voice Commands Plus Haptic Feedback to Make Cooking Safer for the Blind." It was written by Sean McNulty, and it was published in Yanko Design. Cookware developed specifically for the blind and visually impaired communities requires a good blend of ergonomic and tactile design elements. While today's product designs across industries shoot for minimalism, ditching bulky gear for a more elemental and bare look, the lack of sensory components overlooks those who might benefit from an ergonomic design like the visually impaired community. French industrial designer Dorian Femet created Ugo, a two-part induction stovetop to help streamline work in the kitchen for the blind community. Ugo is a portable, two-part induction stovetop that helps blind people navigate cooking through haptic dials and an overall ergonomic build. At the center of Ugo's design, Famine incorporated a chunky stove dial that clicks into place when turned to the right. The size of the stove dial enhances the stove's ergonomic design by guiding the user's sense of touch to stovetop's main power function. Famine's stovetop also implements wide, easy-to-grip handles, ensuring safe carrying and boosting the stove's tactile attributes. Ugo also recites step-by-step recipes to users, weaving in a sense of hearing to aid blind people's experiences in the kitchen. This addition allows room for users to engage with cookware and accessories already in their kitchen and get cooking while Ugo narrates each step along the way. While cookware for the visually impaired still has a long way to go, designers notice the lack of inclusive home products and create appliances that streamline everyday tasks, striking a balance between tactile, bulky stove dials and clever incorporation of sensory elements. Femin's Ugo boasts accessibility without compromising its refined personality. I read that word for word verbatim because I thought it was written in such a poetic way, also kind of in a little bit of an advertorial way. But if you are interested in learning more about Ugo, it's spelled U-G-O, Ugo. And the designer is Famine, so F-A-M-I-N. But Ugo, U-G-O, is where you can learn more about this tactile stove top. Very neat, and I love talking about stuff in the kitchen that might be able to help you engage in your culinary lifestyle while still doing it safely. Let's bring in Nazreen Abdelmajid. She has the entertainment report. Nazreen, you're filling in for Daniel for the next couple of weeks. So what do you have on top of your mind when it comes to entertainment today?
Yes, so Travis Scott and Kendall Jenner are buzzing all over entertainment. So I thought I'd talk about it, whether you care or not.
I do like Travis Scott.
Yeah, I love Travis Scott.
I don't know if Kendall Jenner has actual talents, but she's very famous.
We'll see. She's gorgeous. But anyways, aside from that, Travis Scott recently shared a snippet of new music on Instagram. However, Kendall Jenner was a little disappointed to see someone special not have a cameo in his latest video. What? Travis Scott, I'm trying to add, you know, a little excitement to this, right? But we'll see. Travis Scott recently took to Instagram to share a short visual of his new music video. There was something, or rather someone, missing that immediately caught the model's eye. And the image shown on screen shows the comments made on Instagram. The Sicko Mode rapper captioned the post, Some ask me how I'm starting tonight off. I'm a making a scheme. Who's ready? I want the rage tonight. This isn't me saying this. I'm just quote unquote, this is what it says. In the clip posted, at least three black dogs were seen running down a hill at one point, which prompted Kendall to jokingly comment, "The fact that Pyro didn't get casted for this." And Pyro, for those who may not know, is none other than Kendall's black Doberman that was introduced to the world back in 2018. And okay. She's even joked that she's practically raising her own model. So all of this, and then Travis wrote back, "See, when I was shooting this, I for sure said Pyro needed to pull up. I'm shooting Pyro for the cover." So this made headlines.
Dog drama. Hashtag dog drama.
Dog drama. And I never thought I would report something like this ever. But it's all over entertainment. So I'm like, should I? Yes. Should I not?
Yes,
I
think you should, because this is the modern stuff. And now with Dave Brown is a modern show, Nazreen.
That's true.
I've got questions. Yes, Are they dating? Are Travis Scott and Kendall Jenner dating?
Kylie. Okay. So let me get you. Okay.
Yes. Okay. Walk me through the dating tree here, because I know NBA player Ben Simmons was dating a Jenner, but I think they broke up.
So Kylie and Travis Scott were together.
Okay.
But a little over a month ago, after Kylie, Travis Scott, and Stormy hit the red carpet for an event, they seemed a little cozy. So all the fans are buzzing. Are they back together? Are they not? I don't know. So that's the latest news. We don't know. It's okay. Not official. But of course, the fans are like, yes, bring them back together. I thought they were cute, to be honest. I thought they were a good fit. And I know Travis Scott really cares for Stormy, so
Which one is the handbag designer? Which is the one who made like the billions of dollars designing handbags?
Isn't it Kim Kardashian? Okay, I'm asking you.
Yeah, you're definitely asking the wrong person.
It might be Kim Kardashian, because Kylie has the makeup.
Maybe it's the makeup. I've lost the thread. I've lost the thread.
Because I'm not really into watching their reality show. I'm just not that type of person.
Okay.
But saying this on TV. But yeah, so I think that's what they all have this business going. Good for them. But yeah, that was it.
Nazreen, we have a Kardashian Jenner insider. Our audio producer Sam Robinson has the scoop.
I mean, I'm not. I wouldn't say the insider, but I do know that it is Kim Kardashian who is.
I was right.
Running the bags. She has the bags. Okay. She also has cosmetics and some shapewear, is described as.
I think she has like contour and everything. Yeah, She has quite a few things going on for her.
I love this. Okay, this is definitely a different brand of entertainment report than Daniel's, and I love it. I love it. No video games in this one. We're talking about the Jenners and the Kardashians. Nazreen, top end job. Love it. Great, but
hitting a different highlight to entertainment.
Hey, entertainment's a big broad term. You know, like there's music. We don't do a lot of music with Dano, so maybe we'll get a little music with you here for the next couple of weeks. Yeah. We're gonna get some celebrity. Celebrity drama, gossip. I love it. Let's keep changing things up a little bit. We are not dogmatic, even when we're talking about hashtag dog drama on Now with Dave Brown. See? Like how I spun that. Nazreen, because you gave me a cursory laugh there, you can stick around to tell us what's trending. Nazreen, what's trending on social media?
So one of Canada's top trends is hashtag Maggie McNeil. Canada's Maggie McNeil has won Canada's first gold medal in the Tokyo Olympics Monday after finishing first in the women's 100-meter butterfly. And I just want to quickly point out that the image shown on screen shows Maggie McNeil wrapped in a Canadian flag standing on a giant gold medal projected on the floor.
Nice.
And, yeah, spot on. So surprise, surprise, Olympics. It's going to be probably trending for the next few weeks.
Couple weeks, yeah, for sure.
Or this week. I was looking over Twitter and I'm like, oh my God, it's all about the Olympics. Will Dave be mad?
No,
what is up?
You know, unlike, because you were here last week when I went on my little rant about my ethical dilemma around the Olympics and Paralympics that are going on.
And
I think it's just important that I acknowledge that I have this ethical dilemma, that I do feel a bit of like forces being pulled in different directions at me. But Nazreen, bear in mind, I watch college football every Saturday, American college football every Saturday in the fall, which is like the ultimate ethical dilemma. So the fact if I can reconcile that on any given Saturday, I can certainly reconcile the Olympics and certainly get sort of riled up and enjoy when Maggie McNeil wins that gold. When we had a Kate Klimkate win a bronze medal in judo earlier today, the first ever Canadian woman to win a medal in judo. I love that stuff. Like there's still a lot of personal stories celebrate during the Olympics. And I still enjoy it. Even if I have that little thing tickling me in the back of my brain being like, is this going to make a global pandemic worse?
I know. I totally agree with you for that when you mentioned it last week. These are such proud moments for the Olympics. So I also want to point out Maggie McNeil is 21, finished with a time of 55.59 seconds, setting a Canadian record at her first Olympic Games. And according to Global News, McNeil now adds Olympic champion to her swimming resume, a compliment to the world title she won 2 years ago in Gwangju, South Korea. McNeil knew the world title meant she was going to surprise anyone in Tokyo. And Canada currently holds 3 medals at the 2020 Tokyo Olympics, all in the swimming category, which is epic. And the silver medal went to China's Zhang Yufei, and the bronze to Australia's Emma McKeon. So it's pretty good. It was a thrill. And I've seen all over on Twitter. So these are such proud moments. I'm proud of her. 21. That's an accomplishment.
Yeah, absolutely. Nice to see young athletes having that success. Nazreen, thank you for this. You were a wonderful success today as well. So have yourself a great day, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
Sounds good.
That's a gold medal for Nazreen today. So now let's give Canada 5 medals. Just throw in one for Nazreen there. Put her on the podium as well. Let's bring in Mike Ross, who also will give him a medal too for this day in history, the now of then, preemptively.
Hey, as long as I hit my personal best, Dave, I'm a happy man.
It's all about PRs, personal
that
records.
That is right. We're going back to 1875 for our first note. Psychologist Carl Jung was born in Kesseville, Switzerland. He founded analytical psychology and introduced the concepts of introvert and extrovert personalities.
And the collective unconscious.
Oui. 1936, King Edward VIII unveiled the Vimy Ridge Memorial at the site of the 1917 First World War battle in northern France. The memorial was designed by Canadian sculptor Walter Allward. The monument took 11 years to build. Several thousand Canadians made a pilgrimage to the site for the dedication and continued to visit to this day. In 1998, three spectators were killed at the U.S. 500 auto race in Brooklyn, Michigan, after a tire hurtled into the stands after a single car crash. And those are your events and happenings this day in history.
Thanks so much for that, Mike. Let's bring in Ramya Amuthan, who is the co-host of Kelly & Company, which comes your way at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on AMI Audio. And Ramya joins us now. Hey, good morning, Ramya.
Morning, Dave. Hope you had a good long weekend.
I did have a good long weekend. And Ramya, even before I start asking you questions about today's show, I need to ask you our daily poll at AMI Audio on Twitter, Accessible Media Inc. on Facebook. We're asking the listeners and the viewers and the social media peeps today if you could compete in any Paralympic or Olympic summer sport, which one would it be? And we've got the general categories here, but we're encouraging people to get specific. But let me give you the categories. You've got track and field, water sports, cycling, gymnastics. But of course, there are so many other sports available there, Ramya, including sort of specific competitions as well. So if you could compete in one, which one would it be?
Well, let's assume that I would be amazing at one of these things in order to answer this question.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Okay. Like, we're assuming that you've like done the training and like you've got the ability and the talent to do whatever you want here on this list.
Yeah, not that like I suck at swimming and somehow it's going to be part of my Olympic journey to be part of it. But let's just pretend I'm an amazing swimmer. It would be something of the swimming sports. I think it's just because I've had conversations with athletes who've done the swimming as part of Olympics and as part of competitive journeys. And I find it so lovely to be hitting the water and doing what you love. And that would be probably something that I'd take part in.
The thing that I love about swimming in particular and why I would never do it at a competitive level is that it's an incredible combination of skill and will. There's a lot of sports where just like a willingness to compete can drag you through. Now, that said, you still need to develop skills to be elite. But, you know, the running technique, eventually you can sort of figure out. Whereas when you're talking about swimming, and not only is it incredibly difficult on the lungs and the muscles, the precision of every movement is so important. Your stroke needs to be perfect. So it's one of those sports that's really about the combination of the skill and the will, which I think is just tremendous. Yeah.
I've always been pretty proud of my ability to hold my breath underwater, though, so who knows?
So you're halfway there. You're halfway there. If you have the lung capacity, you're halfway there. Now we're talking.
Generously, loosely halfway there.
Ramya, what's coming up on the show this afternoon?
Okay, we're talking to Brock Richardson of the Neutral Zone. He's giving us our weekly sports update to kick off the show with.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to talk about the AMI original documentary called Pivot Like a Boss. It's airing this Friday on AMI TV. And Wendy Purvis in Halifax is going to be giving us the details on what to look forward to. They've profiled some really incredible entrepreneurs for this documentary. We're also learning about Opera Italia's releasing their first ever online audio described film adaptation of Handel's The Resurrection. So we catch up with them kind of annually. They always have really cool projects going on for the blind and partially sighted community. So looking forward to this one as well.
Well, all those different topics on the show, you guys are going to have to pivot like a boss to get from segment to segment. So I wish you luck with that endeavor. Ramya, always fun catching up. Have yourself a great day, a great show, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
Talk tomorrow.
That's Ramya Amuthan. She's the co-host of Kelly & Company. Comes your way 2 p.m. Eastern Time on AMI Audio. Coming up next, Jim Crisco will give you the Western Regional Report and describe Saskatchewan's commitment to a new skills training program. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Just before we get to Jim Crisco, I've got one more news story to share with you, and it comes from the world of politics. And it's I guess, framed in what I was complaining to you about last week about some of the speculation, the ongoing speculation about a federal election, which at times is a little bit, I feel, the industry trying to talk it into reality because it's something to talk about. But nonetheless, this story is actually quite interesting. An analysis by the Canadian Press shows federal conservative candidates' ridings-based war chests are flush with cash. Don Kelly crunches the numbers.
Financial statements show conservative riding associations have an average of just under $61,000 in net assets, almost $25,000 more than the Liberals as of the end of last year. New Democratic and Green riding associations had averages in the four-digit range. With an election on the horizon, Lori Turnbull, the director of Dalhousie University's School of Public Administration, says tracking the money is important because parties will move it around between associations to concentrate resources in contestable races. Don Kelly, The Canadian Press.
Let's go from the world of politics to Jim Crisco. Every couple of days, we connect with our AMI colleagues across the country to find out what's going on in their neck of the woods. So Jim Crisco is here for the Western Regional Report, and Jim is an AMI content development specialist, and he joins us from Edmonton, Alberta. Hey, good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Dave.
So, Jim, you've got a couple stories here. Let's begin in Manitoba, where three human rights complaints allege First Nations adults with disabilities are being left behind in the province. So, Jim, bring us up to speed with these complaints.
Sure. There's actually three. They're being brought forward by the Public Interest Law Center on behalf of two Manitoba First Nations people and a coalition of Indigenous adults with disabilities. And what it is there's really two parts to these complaints, and I'll tell you a couple of the specific complaints. But it really deals with two things. One is aging out of supports, mm-hmm, as you become an adult. So when you become 19 years old, and the other one is supports available on First Nations, on the First Nations properties as well, where that is definitely lacking. This story, by the way, is by the CBC. What's happened is there's an example, or one of the people is Aiden Wilson, who's a 19-year-old from Peguis First Nation. And he lived in Winnipeg for most of his life. He has six different heart conditions. He had cancer as a baby, suffered a stroke. He's paralyzed on the right side of his face, arm, and leg. So he has some medical challenges for sure. And what happened was his disability-related services weren't available on his First Nation for most of his life. So they had to move to the city. So they had to live in Winnipeg and be separated from his community and culture, because those services weren't available on the First Nation property. So that's one of the challenges. The other one is there's a lady named Carly Sinclair, who's 30, and when she was 4 years old, she contracted a rare neurological order from a mosquito bite, and she uses a wheelchair and requires daily care. And she was unable to finish high school as she had no supports. And still doesn't receive regular hospital visits. So they're saying that she was that First Nations adults are denied social inclusion and the ability to meaningfully participate in daily life. So these are an example, or these are the cases that are brought forward, and they do represent a much larger number of people who are probably going through the exact same situations.
Yeah, it speaks to a marginalization that a lot of people with disabilities are feeling, and then it becomes magnified or intensified when you add some of the discriminations that people of Indigenous people, as well as First Nations people across the country face as well. It's almost like that double discrimination, which creates even more difficulty in getting that access. So, Jim, thank you for bringing us the details on these stories, as we know that it's one that resonates with so many people listening to the show and watching the show this morning. Jim, we go from Manitoba over to Saskatchewan, where the provincial government has committed $13 million to new skills training programs. So, Jim, what are these programs? What are these programs exactly? What are these programs they're investing in?
They are investing $13 million into basically programs that will help grow a skilled workforce in the province. And so what they're doing is they're targeting training for economic opportunities. They're promoting recruitment and retention of young people, support participation. This is really key. Support participation of those currently underrepresented in the workforce, and to continue growing engaged and inclusive workforce in the future. So once again, oh, this is from Global News, by the way, in Saskatchewan. So once again, they're opening up opportunities for more young people to be able to access, whether it be trades or whether it be university courses. They're specifically targeting people who might not have had opportunity in the past to get this education.
Yeah, it's one of these things that we identify the importance all the time of education, right? But it's just empty to say, oh, education's the key, education's the tool, if you're not investing the dollars to give people the resources to A, get into those programs, but B, make sure there's accommodations in those programs so they can actually complete the programs, and then C, making sure there's continued investment to get people actually working out in the field. College degrees, university degrees aren't going to help you if you can't get relevant field experience, and we know that having disabilities means it's hard to even get through the door when that's the situation on the front end.
Absolutely. One of the programs that they have specifically geared for the disability community is a disability services program for adult learners with disabilities and newcomer services programming to provide in-demand skills training and language training for newcomers. So there's the disability services program specifically targets and is of benefit to adult learners with disabilities. So there is, it's really a very, very, I would say, good thing to have in place, but also a very necessary thing at this point, because, you know, with people returning to work from the pandemic, et cetera, there's going to be a need for skilled labor. There's going to be a need for folks to fill positions. And this is a great timing on this.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. Okay, Jim, before I let you go, I've got a couple questions for you. One from the Olympics world, our daily poll, but I've also got an Edmonton Oilers question for you. But let's begin with the daily poll. So at AMI Audio on Twitter, Accessible Media Inc. on Facebook. Jim, if you could take part in any summer Olympic or Paralympic sport, which event do you choose? And once again, I'm going to mention we have some broad categories here as options, but I'm looking for some specifics in your answer. So track and field, water sports, cycling, gymnastics. Now, Jim, of course, you can go off the board outside those categories as well. So what say you, Jim, if you were an elite athlete, what would you want to take part in?
Well, the pragmatic part of me was trying to think of what is the most marketable sport so that I could get endorsements.
Get on that Wheaties box.
Exactly. And you'd think that I take gymnastics since gym is right in the title, but I'm not. I would probably go track and field, and specifically pole vaulting. Because that to me looks like the most fun. To be able to hurl yourself over a high bar like that and land in a pillow, that seems like a gas.
I was at the bar with a couple friends on Saturday, and that was definitely their perspective. They said something like pole vaulting, high jumping, long jumping, discus throwing, shot put, any of that kind of stuff. They were like, something where you get to throw or jump or do something kind of fun. They were like, let's do an activity as opposed to just making me, you know, run marathons every day.
Absolutely. There just seems like there'd be this exhilaration of, you know, the getting that high and then falling onto something soft. So
yeah, you've also really identified. Everyone was like, oh, I want to fall on the giant cushy pillow thing, which definitely makes sense as well. At AMI Audio on Twitter, Accessible Media Inc. on Facebook. We already got a voicemail from Elizabeth in Montreal, so we'll play that one tomorrow. But you can call in 1-866-509-4545, 1-866-509-4545, or at AMI, or feedback at AMI.ca is where you can send an email as well. Okay, Jim, just as we're wrapping up here, we know you're a devout Edmonton Oilers fan. There have been some, some moves being made, a couple reported ones and a couple confirmed ones. Duncan Keith, former Chicago Blackhawk, a couple years left on that contract, maybe a little bit of an aging corpse. He's going to be joining your defense corps. There's leading in that question, but how do you feel about Duncan Keith joining the team?
I don't mind it. A lot of people were upset because of his age and the point of his career that he's at. But I think we need the leadership. We need someone who's been deep in the playoffs and won the cup. I think it's a good thing.
And several reporters, including Elliot Friedman and Frank Saravelli of TSN, have suggested that Zach Hyman, Toronto Maple Leafs winger, is going to be joining the Oilers squad. Jim, how does it feel to snatch a winger away from the Toronto Maple Leafs?
That's always a good day, Dave. And I've heard very good things about him. I mean, the best things being said about him are by Toronto fans. So that tells you something, that they really like him.
He must have done something really good in a different life to have gotten to play with Austin Matthews for a couple of years, and now he gets to play with Connor McDavid or Leon Draisaitl. That's good living.
Exactly.
He was helping all kinds of old ladies across the street in a different life, if reincarnation is a thing. Jim, always fun catching up with you. Have yourself a great week, and we'll talk to you again in a couple weeks for another Western Regional Reports.
Thanks, Dave. Have a great week.
That's Jim Crisco. He's a regional content development. He's a content development specialist for AMI, and he joined us from Edmonton, Alberta. That's all the time we have for the show today, but don't worry, we'll be back again tomorrow. We're going to have a very important conversation with Fareed Khan from Canadians United Against Hate. He'll reflect on the recent summit held on Islamophobia. We'll also be joined by Nelson Rego of Cool Blind Tech, and we'll catch up with the gang for the weekly news quiz. Don't forget, there's also a special segment tomorrow with myself and Andrika Delanerol, who are going to be talking about what it's like to go to the movies. Movie theaters open in the majority of the country once again. Andrika's gone, I've gone, so we're going to talk about how it felt to get back in the big old movie theater. That's Now with Dave Brown. The show starts 9 a.m. Eastern time on AMI Audio and AMI TV. Until then, I'm Dave Brown, reminding you to play safe, play fair, but don't forget to have some fun.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.